Warner Brothers continued to be an unofficial propagandist for the New Deal after the election. In 1933, the studio released The Road Is Open Again, which served precisely the function performed by the Nazi propaganda offices. In this film, the spirits of Presidents Washington, Lincoln, and Wilson praise the current president. Washington: "Well, Abe, it looks as though we can stop worrying about our country." Roosevelt: "Has it headed right again." Lincoln: "All it needed was a plan of action and a man with the courage to carry it through." Wilson: "There isn't a person in America who won't benefit by the NRA if every man, woman, and child does his part." Washington: "You can always depend on Americans."
Poor boy has fallen asleep. He's been writing a song for the NRA.
There's nothing like a good song to inspire a nation.
Things are getting better every day.
Well, Abe, it looks as though we can stop worrying about our country. President Roosevelt has it headed right again.
All it needed was a plan of action and a man with the courage to put it through.
There isn't a person in America who won't profit by the National Recovery Administration if every man, woman, and child will do his part.
You can always depend upon Americans.
Did I hear someone mention NRA? Oh, I didn't realize who you were. You see, I've just been writing a patriotic song. I must have fallen asleep.
Don't excuse yourself, my boy. We've been watching you. In fact, I've been watching everything that has happened in this country for over 157 years. I've seen it grow from 13 states to the greatest and strongest country in the world. And now, through the National Recovery Administration, the NRA, it is striving forward to finer and better things.
I know the NRA is a great thing for America, but you see, I'm just like thousands of others. I hardly know exactly how it operates. If you'd explain it to me, it might give me an idea for my song.
Just what do you want to know?
What is the idea behind the NRA? What'll it do?
It will end unemployment and restore the purchasing power of the American people, a thing this country has been trying to do for many years.
Oh, great. Tell me more about it, will you?
President Roosevelt has asked each employer to split up existing work to give more people jobs and see to it that every man has a living wage.
Yes, a man and every man's job. I live to see the freeing of the slaves. But this is a step toward the freeing of the slaves of the sweatshops, eliminating child labor, and giving the toilers a chance to enjoy the beauties of life.
What can I do to help it out?
You and 120 million other Americans can help by patronizing stores that display the Blue Eagle. Those stores are sharing to bring back prosperity.
I suppose everybody is compelled to sign the NRA code.
No, this is a gentleman's agreement. President Roosevelt is asking each to lend a helping hand for the common good.
Oh, I see. As soon as everybody goes back to work, they have more money to spend, and that would increase business everywhere. Is that right?
That's it exactly. The more people buy, the more things the manufacturers will have to make, and the farmers will have to grow. And the road to better times will be open again.
The road to better times. Open again. Open. Why, that's it. That's an idea for my song. Listen, here it is.
There's a new day in view. There is gold in the blue. There is hope in the hearts of men. All the world's on the way to a sunnier day, for the road is open again. There's a note of repair. There's a song in the air. It's the music of busy men. Every plow in the land meets a happier hand, 'cause the road is open again. There's an eagle blue in the White House too, on the shoulder of our our president there. The lusty call telling one and all, brother, do your share. There's a new day in view, there is gold in the blue, there is hope in the hearts of men. From the plain to the hill, from the farm to the mill, all the road is open again. Everybody sing it there.
There's a new day in view, there is gold in the blue, there is hope in the hearts of men. All the world's up the lane, the sunnier day, comes the road it is open again. There's a note of repair, there's a song in the air, it's the music of busy. Every plow in the land meets a happier hand, cause the road is open again. There's eagles blue in the White House too, on the shoulder of our president there. With a lusty call telling one and all, brother, do your share. There's a new day in you, there is gold in the blue, there is hope in the hearts of men. From the plain to the hill, from the farm to the mill, on the road is open
everybody, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. I'm Brett, and I'm joined in the studio today by Antigone, darling. Antigone is from Sex, Lies, and Anarchy.
Hello.
And also joining us in the studio is Carlos Morales, who is here promising to behave.
I will try.
And
you
Carlos.
Know, oh, no, yeah, I'm from Truth Over Comfort. See, I'm already interrupting you with my spiciness, so I'll go ahead and try to keep it down.
And the three of us are here to talk to Thaddeus Russell and continue with part two of our Behold a Dictator show. We started this actually back in June. We decided it needed to be a two-parter because I wanted to make sure we could devote sufficient attention to the topics of film and news media in the United States around the time of the New Deal and also in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. So, Thad, welcome back.
Hey, guys.
So we left off last time. We had just scratched the surface of Hollywood during the New Deal, and we were talking about Neil Gabler's book, An Empire of Their Own, and this assimilation of Jews. We threw around terms like cultural Holocaust. Remember that? Is that Gabler's term or is that your term?
It's mine.
Yeah?
You might use it, but it's I think it's more mine.
And why do you use it?
Because that's really what was going on with, you know, Hollywood Jews in particular. I'd say Jewish Americans in general, although not, of course, across the board. But Hollywood, the Hollywood moguls of the 20s, 30s, and 40s were undoubtedly, and Gabler really documents as well, I mean, were not just assimilationists, they were violently hostile to Jewishness and to a distinctive Jewish culture, and really aggressively were assimilating into American culture. Said things that anyone would now consider to be blatantly anti-Semitic. You know, they gave lavish Christmas parties at their mansions, and, you know, they forced all of the Jewish movie stars to change their names to WASP names, and, you know, said things like, I hate Jews, and God forbid I should ever be Jewish again, and, you know, the last thing I want is anything Jewish in my movies. And one of the things that happened, and this is, I don't think I really talk about this in the book, Gabler certainly does, is that the old vaudeville tradition, which was really the dominant form of entertainment in America in the early 20th century, was banished from films in the period that I talk about in the book. The vaudeville form, which was not exactly invented by Jews, but it was certainly perfected by Jews, and they were highly identified with vaudeville, which was quite sexual, bawdy, sort of raucous, non-respectable in many ways, certainly not bourgeois. It also incorporated quite a bit of African-American culture, jazz, ragtime, or very, very large parts of vaudeville minstrel shows. And that was really, so that was in the movies before the 1930s, but beginning with the 1930s, the Jewish Hollywood moguls sort of obliterated that as well. So you don't see really any semblance of that in Hollywood films beginning of the 1930s.
It's not discussed in the book, but obviously, well, this part is discussed in the book. The 1930s is a time of great pressure, I think, coming down on Hollywood and the application of all these constraints from government. But all of these Jewish studio moguls, they seem to just be self-censoring their Jewishness. The pressure didn't seem to be coming from anywhere.
Yeah, it's a very important story that many, many people have told before. The motion picture production code, people may have heard of the code. So the motion picture production code was drafted by the Hollywood studios themselves in 1930, but it was not enforced until 1934. And everyone should go online and read the motion picture production code. I teach it to my students. It's one of those things where it's sort of like simultaneously horrifying and tragic and comic because of what they banned in movies. They banned all sorts of things from showing women who were pregnant to any show of disrespect for authority.
Yeah.
To, you know, all suggestions of sexuality were taken out of movies by the Motion Picture Production Code. So I argue that the timing of it was not coincidental. That it was drafted in 1930. This is before Roosevelt, of course, becomes president. Roosevelt's elected in 1933, or he takes office in 1933.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin enforcing the code in 1934. Now, the federal government did not, as far as we know anyway, did not formally force Hollywood to institute the code.
Right.
But we do know that they were very encouraging of the code and supported it and celebrated it. We also know that the Hollywood studios of the time in the 30s, but in particular in the 1940s, were very, very pro-Roosevelt, very pro-New Deal, that there were many Hollywood movies beginning in 1933, 34, that were essentially propaganda pieces for the New Deal. And there's lots of examples of that. You can look online. There are many books about that. And then also what we know is that it was in the interest of Hollywood to avoid censorship. And we also know that the New Deal government, beginning in 1933, was actively censoring media. So they actively censored radio in many, many ways. That's documented in my book and elsewhere.
In the U.S., there was some heavy-handed censorship, but far more willing submission by the press itself. Roosevelt appointed loyalists to the Federal Communications Commission, who made it clear that licenses would be revoked for broadcasters who aired programs critical of the government. In 1934, the Yankee Radio Network of New England promised to give the president a lot of support after it received warnings from an FCC commissioner. An executive for another network said that the fear of government intervention would blue pencil a dozen programs for every one that an official censor might object to. In the first weeks of the Roosevelt administration, NBC instituted a policy barring the president's critics from its broadcasts. Henry Bellows of CBS told Roosevelt's press secretary immediately after the inauguration that the close contact between you and the broadcasters has tremendous possibilities of value to the administration, and as a lifelong Democrat, I want to pledge my best efforts in making this cooperation successful. In 1935, CBS celebrated the second anniversary of the New Deal with Of the People, By the People, For the People, a program in which professional actors recreated great moments in the administration's first 2 years. The U.S. Office of Education mandated that civics classes in public schools play the two-hour program for students. Boak Carter of CBS was the most popular political commentator until 1938, when he was fired for his increasingly critical remarks about the president. Both CBS and NBC continued to ban critics of the New Deal through the 1930s and into the war.
And so it's probable that the Hollywood studios preemptively censored themselves to keep the state from doing it.
Let me ask you this, though. Do you think they knew how heavy-handed in 1932 and 1933? Do you think it was clear to people, not just, I mean, we're talking specifically here about the movie business, but do you think it was clear to people how heavy-handed legally and with respect to regulation the Roosevelt administration was going to be? I mean, what didn't FDR campaign against Hoover, saying that he was too interventionist in the economy?
Did he? I don't know about that.
I believe that they wound up, I forget who it was in Roosevelt's cabinet, but there's a great quote that's very interesting. It kind of like breaks the mainstream narrative of history. He said, yeah, most of the ideas we got for the New Deal, and maybe this is just total bullshit, considering how we looked at the roots of the New Deal ideologically in the last show. He said, we got most of that stuff from the Hoover administration. Those were all plans that they had.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, we know that Hoover was a corporatist.
Yeah.
Less ambitious than Roosevelt, but he was certainly a corporatist. In fact, many people have argued that Hoover was the first corporatist president, and actually, I think, used the term.
There are a number of myths about the Great Depression which are very popular. The first is that Herbert Hoover was a do-nothing, laissez-faire president who simply allowed unemployment to rise and was responsible for a total economic collapse. In fact, this is the opposite of the truth. Hoover was an extremely interventionist president, and one of the main reasons why the Great Depression became so severe was because of the active and interventionist policy he followed, in particular his refusal to allow asset values and wages to find a natural clearing level. The second myth is that the New Deal saved American capitalism and brought the Great Depression to an end. The historians generally do not believe this anymore. The fact is that in most parts of the world, the Great Depression began to end much, much earlier and much more quickly than it did in the United States. In Great Britain, the Great Depression was over by 1933, and Britain in fact enjoyed very rapid economic growth from 1931 onwards. In the United States, by contrast, not only does the Great Depression go on for more than a decade, it in fact actually gets worse, and by 1937, the level of unemployment in the United States is as high as it had been in 1932, but in addition, the federal government has built up an enormous debt.
Yeah, I know that Roosevelt's rhetoric during the campaign made suggestions toward laissez-faire, but, you know, and of course switched as soon as he took office. Did people know about the heavy-handedness of the Roosevelt administration in terms of censorship? Probably not.
Right.
You know, they didn't have the internet then, and the government wasn't announcing that it was censoring radio shows. I'm sure a few people did, but I don't think it was not widely discussed. I don't think you can find evidence of it in the New York Times in the 1930s, for instance.
So you think it was more about support and loyalty than kind of a fear that they were going to come down on Hollywood and the press anyway?
I think it was both, but they were very, very sympathetic. It was a self-censorship that was probably done quite willingly and enthusiastically, actually.
So maybe we could hit some of the highlights of the code. I know one of them, when this is a very convenient one, was the idea that no law shall be ridiculed, which I guess was super convenient for an administration that was about to create all these regulatory laws.
Yeah,
but there's others as well.
The actual text of it is awesome. I mean, I could pull it up if you want. I have it.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
When I teach this, my students love it. They can't believe it. So here's the text of the Motion Picture Production Code of 1934. It was revised and enforced in 1934. But this is the actual text. Motion picture producers recognize the high trust and confidence which have been placed in them by the people of the world and which have made motion pictures a universal form of entertainment. They recognize their responsibility to the public because of this trust and because entertainment and art are important influences in the life of a nation. So already you see the nationalist imperative there. Hence, though regarding motion pictures primarily as entertainment without any explicit purpose of teaching or propaganda, they know that the motion picture within its own field of entertainment may be directly responsible for spiritual or moral progress, for higher types of social life. That's one of my favorite phrases.
Mm-hmm.
And for much is the best, for much correct thinking.
Wow.
Much correct thinking. That sounds good. That's what we want.
You know, that's quite interesting, though, because if we look up kind of the cultural Marxists or the people who bring up cultural Marxism, as in the major media brands from the 1930s up until now have been about trying to destroy in some way the foundation of America, the Puritan work ethic, the Puritan views of sex. That is kind of antithetical to that theory. I don't know if you've studied much of what basically a lot of people have had concerns of regarding some term called cultural Marxism.
Well, I hate that term, but
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do, because essentially, some of your work would be considered. Oh, well, this is kind of under the culture Marxist motif. It's something that is going against the conservative view.
I don't mind using the term as long as it's precisely applied and defined. It tends to get thrown around in meaningless ways to me. So yeah, I've been called a cultural Marxist. So the conservative critique of popular culture is that it breaks down traditional American values and culture, that it sexualizes the culture, that it diminishes the work ethic, that it degrades the family, that it sows disrespect for authority and American institutions. Mm-hmm. Now, that, in my view, is both totally correct and totally false. With the New Deal popular culture, with the popular culture between roughly 1933 and the mid-1960s, when the Motion Picture Production Code was in effect, and when the New Deal as a political regime was dominant, it's pretty false, not entirely, but certainly in Hollywood, it's pretty false. So if you look at the Motion Picture Production Code and you look at the films that were made by Hollywood studios during that period, they should be very pleasing to people who believe in upholding traditional American values. The Motion Picture Production Code included these provisions, these rules. Crimes against the law. These shall never be presented in such a way as to throw sympathy with the crime as against law and justice, or to inspire others with a desire for imitation. Murder. The technique of murder must be presented in a way that will not inspire imitation. Brutal killings are not to be presented in detail. Revenge in modern times shall not be justified. Methods of crime should not be explicitly presented. Theft, robbery, safe cracking, and dynamiting of trains, mines, buildings, etc. should not be detailed in method. Mm-hmm. Arson must be subject to the same safeguards. The use of firearms should be restricted to essentials. Methods of smuggling should not be presented. Illegal drug traffic must never be presented. The use of liquor in American life, when not required by the plot or for proper characterization, will not be shown. Sex. The sanctity of the institution of marriage and the home shall be upheld. Pictures shall not infer that low forms of sex relationship are the accepted or common thing. Adultery, sometimes necessary plot material, must not be explicitly treated or justified or presented attractively. Scenes of passion, they should not be introduced when not essential to the plot. Excessive and lustful kissing, lustful embraces, suggestive postures and gestures are not to be shown. In general, passion should so be treated that these scenes do not stimulate the lower and baser element. So under seduction or rape, number four is sex perversion, which was a euphemism for homosexuality, or any inference to it is forbidden. Miscegenation, sex relationships between the white and black races, is forbidden. Sex hygiene and venereal diseases are not subjects for motion pictures, it says. Scenes of actual childbirth, in fact or in silhouette, are never to be presented. Section number three, vulgarity. The treatment of low, disgusting, unpleasant, though not necessarily evil subjects, should be subject always to the dictates of good taste and a regard for the sensibilities of the audience. Obscenity. Obscenity in word, gesture, reference, song, joke, or by suggestion is forbidden. Profanity, pointed profanity, this includes the words God, Lord, Jesus, Christ, unless used reverently, hell, SOB, damn, and God, or every other profane or vulgar expression, however used, is forbidden. Complete nudity is never permitted. This includes nudity in fact or in silhouette, or any lecherous or licentious notice thereof by other characters in the picture. Undressing scenes should be avoided and never used save where essential to the plot. Indecent or undue exposure is forbidden. Dancing costumes intended to permit undue exposure or indecent movements in the dance are forbidden. Dances suggesting or representing sexual actions or indecent passion are forbidden. Dances which emphasize indecent movements are to be regarded as obscene. Religion. No film or episode may throw ridicule on any religious faith. Ministers of religion in their character as ministers of religion should not be used as comic characters or as villains. Ceremonies of any definite religion should be carefully and respectfully handled.
Now, who...
Wait, one more, and here okay, we go. Here's your nationalism. The use of the flag shall be consistently respectful. The history, institutions, prominent people, and citizenry of other nations shall be represented fairly. Then there's things like you can't show hangings, you can't show the third degree method of torture, brutality, branding, apparent cruelty to children or animals, the sale of women, and surgical operations, all banned from Hollywood films for 32 years.
So this Hays Code is pulled in 1967 in favor of the rating system. And I'm guessing that's why we start to see the appearance of films like Easy Rider, The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy, all around that time, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so then what does the film, that makes perfect sense. What does the film industry in the United States look like before the Hays Code is implemented in the mid-1930s?
Yeah, so before the Hays Code, so in the 1920s, especially in the early 1930s, the two most popular genres were the gangster film and what we now call the fallen woman film. The great gangster films of that era, the pre-Hays Code era, included films like Little Caesar and Public Enemy and White Heat. And they're fascinating. These are movies that star Jimmy Cagney and Edward G. Robinson. And they presented the narrative from the point of view of the gangster. I wouldn't say they quite idealized the gangster, but it was a sympathetic, in some ways, portrait of the gangster.
They idealized rebellion.
You could say they idealized rebellion. They certainly didn't condemn it, didn't moralize against it, at least not explicitly. And the other thing that happens in those films is that the police are often presented as objects of ridicule. So the gangsters will often sort of walk up to a cop and like strike a match on his badge and then light a cigar.
Yeah.
Or they're just seen as bumbling or corrupt or, you know, ineffective or sort of getting in the way of this, of the gangsters' rise to power.
Don't go for your guns.
A cop. What do you like, that boy's a cop, and his name is Fallon. And we went for it. I went for it. Treated him like a kid brother. And I was going to split 50-50 with a cop. Maybe they're waiting to pin a medal on him.
Solid gold. Come on, get up. Get your hands up.
Yeah, that's it. A nice gold medal for the cop. Only maybe he's going to get it sooner than he thinks.
You know, and this is during Prohibition, right?
Yeah.
It's very important to understand. And that's the context there. So Prohibition, the great thing about Prohibition, which was, of course, utterly unintended, was that it caused people to disrespect authority, and in particular, legal authority.
Mm-hmm.
That's what actually many people who led the call for Prohibition, that's what led them to call for rescinding it. Because they said by the late 1920s, many of the prohibitionists were saying, hey, this has backfired entirely. People don't trust the cops. They don't have any respect for the president. They don't have any respect for our legal institutions, for our court systems, et cetera. And now they're lionizing these gangsters. So we need to get rid of this law. It's doing exactly the opposite of what we intended.
Do you think that the 1920s and the spirit of the 1920s in the film industry and beyond in popular culture was kind of this decompression period from the 19-teens and the reign of Wilson? Because it's a lot of the same crew that's influencing New Deal policies. Those people are trying to wrap their hands around America in the 19-teens as well, right?
Yeah, it's all progressives. Yeah. I mean, the New Deal is all either the New Dealers, the people in the Roosevelt administration, are all people who began in settlement houses in the 1910s, or they were social workers, or they were progressive intellectuals. I mean, self-identified as such, or they were the children of progressives, basically. So yeah, there's no question about that. The progressives overreached with prohibition. I mean, this was their great mistake. Prohibition was a completely, thoroughly progressive cause. They pushed it through, of course. World War I accelerated the movement for prohibition, and it backfired, as I said. I mean, what happened was they caused people to disrespect authority, the law, the state, police, courts, politicians. And there was also sort of a great flowering of countercultural freedom at that time, much of it led by women. One of the great things about prohibition is that, you know, it gave rise to the speakeasies, which were illegal underground saloons. And of course, so, you know, they're already flouting morality and the law by having a speakeasy open. One of the cultural norms that was done away with by the speakeasy owners was that women should not drink in public. So for the first time, large numbers of American women are drinking in public, and sort of they're there in these bars. And, you know, of course, dancing is happening, sex is happening, people are hooking up, et cetera. So it's a really great flowering moment of American freedom. The other popular, speaking of women drinking and bad things, is the other great genre, the most popular genre of the 1920s and early 1930s was the fallen woman genre. Yeah. So Marlene Dietrich, Greta Garbo, people like that. And these are really amazing films. They have been read by scholars as being militantly feminist. First of all, the women are the stars of the films. They are the center of attention. They have tremendous power. They often end up killing men who double cross them or betray them. Or in some of the films, they actually kill men they just get bored with. They call the shot sexually. They are sexual. They don't have the sort of Victorian prudery about them. They defend themselves. They're sort of scheming and devious, but they get what they want, right? Rather than being sort of women who were engineered just to be mothers and wives.
Right.
So
right.
It's been read by many people, not everyone, but by many people, and certainly by me, as being really militantly feminist, really an attack on Victorian morality for women.
Who's the old gentleman there?
My father.
I like his face. And this Madonna?
The Madonna of Kazan. My mother made a pilgrimage to the Shrine of Miracles to get it for me. Hmm. It's about 100 miles from our town. She walked all the way.
What is it supposed to do? Bring you luck?
Oh, no. It guards you from evil. I had to kneel before the altar and promise mother I would always keep a flame burning before it.
And have you?
Of course. My orderly has taken care of it all the time I've been away.
You're a strange boy.
Who loves you?
Do you?
I love you as one adores sacred things.
What sacred things?
God, country, honor, you.
I come last?
No.
That's how you said it.
You come first, before anything.
Before anything?
Yes.
There's so much light in here. Put out that one too.
The Madonna's lamp?
Yes.
I couldn't do that.
You said I came first.
But don't you understand that it's a holy lamp? That I swore to keep it burning?
You wouldn't do that for me?
Why do you ask me to?
To see if you love me, as you say.
I do, Matt, I do.
Well, then put it out. If you love me.
I'll do anything, but please don't ask me to do that.
I'm going. No.
So those were the most popular genres of Hollywood film, and those were explicitly attacked by the New Deal regime of the 1930s.
Absolutely. Before I ask the next question, either of you guys want to go ahead, Antigone?
Well, you did mention that
in the motion picture, whatever the code that you read, one of the headings was seduction and rape. They're the
both.
that's kind of offensive to, you know, humans to say that seduction and rape are like related, that they're the same thing.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. So, right. So it's what I call the great conflation, which is going on now, by the way. Feminists do this often, you know, they conflate all sex with rape or all sex with coercion.
Yep.
And so there's a great overlap, I think, and others have said, you know, between modern feminism and classical conservatism on this stuff. And that's one of the ways in which this is the case. If you look at, this is kind of a digression, but the new legislation going through Congress right now that heavily regulates sex, basically, on campuses, college campuses. I forget the name of the bill.
Isn't that a California only thing?
Nope. National now.
Jesus.
There's one. It's in the Senate. But a bunch of right-wing Republicans just signed on to it, including Marco Rubio. So it's like Claire McCaskill, big liberal, and Marco Rubio are leading the way on that. And it really heavily regulates sex on campuses. So it actually reminds me of this very much, because it's what ends up happening is that all sorts of sexual activity that most people would never consider to be rape or even assault or even coercion get lumped together with rape.
Yeah.
So it was more than just the gangster films, though, that kind of pushed the Hays Code. It was also films, I mean, even 1895, I think, was the first film where there was actually homosexuals shown. And that was still shown up until whenever the Hays Code got pushed in. And it was Catholic groups who were pushing against the idea of homosexuals, even the homosexuals at the time. Like, prior to the 1930s, whenever homosexuals being in a movie, one, either they'd just be called pansies. But if they were in any way like a main star of the given film, it was always something tragic would happen. Like, yes. It'd be a lesbian to be like, oh, I'm a lesbian. Oh, I must kill myself. Oh, I'm a lesbian. I must kill this other woman. Oh, I'm a lesbian. I should kill everyone. Like, it was this constant thing where even though there were homosexuals in those films, it was always, well, if you're gay, you're fucked.
Yes, and that's true even for the gangster genre. We have to be careful. It wasn't exactly a complete celebration of the gangsters, even in the gangster genre films. They ended up dying at the end of the film. But it was sort of in the way that hip-hop portrays gangsters now, which is, yeah, they live a difficult life and they often get shot to death, but there's something alluring and sexy about it, right?
Yeah.
And that's what everyone knew at the time, and we know now, is there were people identifying with the gangsters in those films, even though they ended up getting shot to death at the end. There was a poll taken by Variety magazine asking people which famous people in American culture did they recognize the most, and gangsters were better known than politicians.
Interesting.
So that really was a problem for government authorities.
Right.
And they were aware of this. So, you know, the gangsters at the time were sexy, and they were also, you have to understand, again, during Prohibition, gangsters were the front lines in the war against that law. Without gangsters, there would have been no booze available. I mean, the Prohibition would have worked without the gangsters. They were the ones who brought in the booze over the border from Canada. They put it on the rum runner boats from Cuba, you know, and distributed it throughout the United States. They opened speakeasies. They ran moonshine operations in the South. I mean, they were heroes, rightly so, for most people. And they didn't kill ordinary folks, by the way. I mean, they killed each other for the most part.
Right.
So what the function they served for the typical American was just giving them booze.
Yeah, you know? They gave people what they wanted, but also
they wanted, right.
But because it was illegal, they were able to make a lot of money off of this, and they would also like get involved in politics, right, or help their communities, their families, etc. Because a lot of this stuff was done with the Italians or the Irish or whatever. So, you know, you needed some help. You went to that guy you grew up with who's now running a gang or whatever, and he'll help you out.
Yeah, the smart ones did. Yeah, absolutely. Right, sure. And they still do that. So the Bloods and the Crips often did similar things. When they were at moments, not always, but at moments, the Bloods and the Crips even, and some New York gangs did too. They gave loans to people. They gave people jobs, not just dealing, but in other ways.
Gotti. People loved Gotti in the 80s and 90s.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Exactly. They were not nice guys and they killed a lot of people and tortured a lot of people. But again, as I said, for the most part, that was just competition among them.
So
for the most part.
this romanticism of the gangster life that is in Hollywood in the late 20s and early 30s, because, I mean, we're talking talkies, so that's 1927 until the Hays Code comes to be in 33 and 34. But when the progressives reestablish power, there very quickly is this merger between the New Dealers and Hollywood, right?
Yes.
And sure. I wanted to go through a couple of examples, starting with before Roosevelt even came to power, and that was Warner Brothers, Jack Warner. Yes. 1932 does something called the Motion Picture Electrical Parade and Sports Pageant.
Yes. It was damn near identical to Nazi parades. That's really not an overstatement. If you look at what that parade was, which was at the Olympic Stadium in Los Angeles, actually.
Yeah.
It was this immense parade with floats and these massive, gaudy performances for Roosevelt. and it was a real cult of personality on display there. It was very, very similar to what was going on in Germany at the time.
Yeah.
So the Warners, yes, the Warners, but all of them. The Warners in particular, though, were really operated from 1932 all the way through the war, 1945. Warner Brothers really operated as a propaganda wing of the federal government. And again, that's not an overstatement. This, I mean, many liberal historians have said this. This is not my crazy idea. They produced many, many films that were just blatantly propagandistic for Roosevelt, for the New Deal, for particular aspects of the New Deal, for the NRA. A lot of Shirley Temple films did this. And then during the war, I mean, it was all out. There were just, you know, huge number of blatantly propagandistic pro-war movies. And that was by all the Hollywood studios.
Yeah. But I love this chapter in the book, but it was like one of the grossest ones to read. It was just so offensive in so many parts. Like, and I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about here, since we're on Warner Brothers. The one where they reanimate like all the dead presidents to praise Roosevelt.
I believe that's the same thing. Yeah, but there's the Blue Meanie, in one of the films, the Blue Meanies are in it, and they're sort of these capitalist ogres who are the bad guys, and the ordinary folk in the town rise up and overcome them and usher in the NRA. And so, and you know, the NRA eagle is prominent, and pictures of Roosevelt are prominent, and you know, there's a real cult of personality running through many Hollywood films during this period.
Absolutely. And it's not just Warner Brothers. In the chapter, you talk about Fox and Columbia as well. And these other two characters, one we are actually touched on, Capra. The other one was Will Rogers.
Sure, yeah. So Will Rogers, and you can visit his house here in L.A. anytime you want. It's quite nice. His two heroes were Franklin Roosevelt and Benito Mussolini. He gave many, many, many speeches on behalf of both.
And we greet you here tonight, not as candidate Roosevelt, but just as neighbor Roosevelt from the other side of the Rocky Mountains.
Rogers was also a great admirer of another world leader. Mussolini, he's the biggest thing in the world today, he said on a speaking tour in 1927, 1 year after he met Il Duce in Italy. Anyone who can put those dagos to work is some guy. Later, in a speech to a crowd of his fans, the number one New Dealer praised Mussolini's militarism. He knows the nations that are great are the ones that have something in the way of sidearms. He knows that without an army and navy, they will never be able to find room for his growing population. That fellow has kept Italy on the upgrade for all these years, and all the time everybody says, oh, he can't last. I have said ever since I met him in 26 that he was by far the greatest guy I had ever met, and there has never been a day since then that I have changed. He has done more for his country than any man ever did for one in a like time. You don't see him shooting at him anymore, do you? He is a whiz, that baby is. I have never yet seen him propose a fool thing.
He died in a plane crash in 1935, but he called himself the number one New Dealer. Acted in several movies that were explicitly pro-New Deal, pro-Roosevelt, hit the campaign trail for Roosevelt, and spoke openly of his admiration for Mussolini and what he was doing for the Italians.
Yeah. Anyone who can put those dagos to work is some guy. I love that line. I've been waiting to use that in a casual conversation. Somebody mentions Mussolini, but I haven't had a chance yet.
Yeah. And Will Rogers, you know, Will Rogers is still considered to be a great American hero, beloved by all. I mean, and I always, whenever, and we go to Will Rogers State Park. It's a place where you can go hiking here. And it's very nice. It's very prominent in LA. Like, everybody knows about Will Rogers State Park and his house is there. And it's, you know, and I just, every time I go there, I think, I wish, I want to post that speech he gave about Mussolini somewhere here.
Yeah. And he, like Cabra, has this recurring theme in his films, right? He has a formula that he uses to basically push these progressive New Deal ideas.
Yeah. It's always sort of the common folk. It's very populist in that way.
Yeah.
The common folk who were oppressed by either corrupt politicians or corrupt businessmen who band together and elect the good guy instead, and then live happily ever after under a corporatist regime. No, they don't say that part, but it's sort of an emotional, it's a visceral New Deal argument.
Right. And are like greedy capitalists presented as the enemies or the antagonists in the films?
Right. Of course, eliding the fact that capitalists wrote all the New Deal legislation. But
sure.
But that was the front that the New Dealers put on, was that, you know, they were fighting against capitalists. And meanwhile, you know, the steel companies were writing the code for their own industry.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's not happening anymore at all, right?
No,
pharmaceutical companies aren't writing the legal code for the FDA or anything else like that. And the EPA has nothing to do with corporate interests.
The American people wrote that law. Okay?
Oh, yeah. That's right. We elected. Wait a moment. We didn't even elect them, did we? No. Yeah,
Obamacare was written by me and you and all. And Shirley Temple.
Anything else, guys, before I go on to Capra?
Just one thing, you know, the modern day equivalent of all this stuff, though, is the video game Call of Duty. Like, as far as like propaganda mill for the youth and everyone else, as far as like movies don't get away with it as well anymore, because like a lot of movies will still have some kind of semi anti-war tilt or something else like that. But the best way to call to the youth in order to be able to get them to think of, you know, essentially it being this exciting heroic thing is by going through video games. Video games right now are rock and roll. And
yeah, I would say, I mean, I think generally that's right. I think but they're less directly propagandistic.
Yeah.
If you look, I mean, so in other words, Call of Duty, as far as I know, I don't think there's a version of it in which you actually are killing Arabs in Yemen, right?
It's not as far as I know. No, I don't think they went
so
that
not,
far.
It's not actual wars being fought now, but it's absolutely pro-military, pro-war, pro-regime, pro-imperialism for sure. I'm just saying, if you look at the New Deal films, especially during the war in the 40s, I mean, it's, you know, there's just dozens and dozens of films that are set in the war, that are promoting the war aggressively.
So before the war, back into the 1930s, we also have Capra. Capra has, in both Mr. Deeds Comes to Town and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, what you describe in the chapter as the folk ethos, which comes from Germany.
Again, these are films in which, you know, the ordinary salt of the earth white folk in small town America face oppression by these overlords, either political elites or business elites, and they find a hero among them, usually played by Jimmy Stewart.
Yes.
You know, a hero among the people who rises into a position of power and then institutes reforms that humiliates the bad people and removes them from office, and all is well. So again, that the Capra films are a little more subtle than like some of the Warner films, which are straight up sledgehammer propaganda pieces. But it did absolutely play into the sort of the New Deal ethos of the common man overcoming and taking power in the government, right? So the New Dealers portrayed themselves as at least representing the common man. They were the Jimmy Stewart of politics, for sure.
But it takes a hero among them.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Yeah. So, right. It's a cult of personality once again. The people themselves can't do it. They must find this pure virtuous character, like the Jimmy Stewart characters, to do it for them. So that's, you know, very much in line with the cult of Roosevelt, as well as with the cult of personality in Italy and Germany at the time.
Order, gentlemen.
All right, sir, I guess I'll just have to speak to the people of my estate from right here. And I'll tell you one thing, that wild horses aren't going to drag me off this floor until those people have heard everything I've got to say, even if it takes all winter.
This is H.V. Kaltenborn speaking. Half of official Washington is here to see democracy's finest show, the filibuster. The right to talk your head off. The American privilege of free speech in its most dramatic form. The least man in that chamber, once he gets and holds that floor by the rules, can hold it and talk as long as he can stand on his feet, providing always, first, that he does not sit down, second, that he does not leave the chamber or stop talking. The galleries are packed. In the diplomatic gallery are the envoys of two dictator powers. They have come here to see what they can't see at home, democracy in action.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it.
How am I doing? I always get a great kick out of that part of the Declaration of Independence. Now, you're not going to have a country that can make these kind of rules work if you haven't got men that have learned to tell human rights from a punch in the nose.
That's good for a headline.
It's a funny thing about men, you know. They all start life being boys.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised some of these senators were boys once.
And that's why it seemed like a pretty good idea to me to get boys out of crowded cities and stuffy basements for a couple of months out of the year and build their bodies and minds for man-sized job, because those boys are going to be behind these desks some of these days. And it seemed like a pretty good idea, getting boys from all over the country, boys of all nationalities and ways of living, getting them together. Let them find out what makes different people tick the way they do. Because I wouldn't give you 2 cents for all your fancy rules if behind them they didn't have a little bit of plain, ordinary, everyday kindness. And a little looking out for the other fella, too. That's pretty important, all that. It's just the blood and bone and sinew of this democracy that some great men handed down to the human race, that's all. But of course, if you've got to build a dam where that boy's camp ought to be to get some graft to pay off some political army or something, well, that's a different thing. Oh, no. If you think I'm going back there and tell those boys in my state and say, look, now, fellas, forget about it. Forget all this stuff I've been telling you about this land you live in is a lot of hooey. This isn't your country. It belongs to a lot of James Taylors. Oh, no, not me. And anybody here that thinks I'm going to do that, they got another thing coming.
And in Germany, you see how this translates into like an ethnic purification. It's very much tied to the soil, the people of that land.
Yeah. And you'll find that in a lot of these movies, the people, the American people, live in small towns.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of small rural or semi-rural town. They tend not to live in New York City for some strange reason, except that it's not strange, right? Because the small town is sort of almost literally attached to the American soil. They're also white. They're also sort of solid working class. They're not on welfare. They're very pure of heart. There's, you know, the code is instituting this, but, you know, there is no jazz. There is no dancing. There is absolutely no suggestion of sexuality whatsoever. And so, you know, so that's what America is. And that's what must be protected from these corrupt, rapacious elites.
I'm kind of thinking now that the Hays Code basically made a career for Hitchcock. Like, his entire thing was the thriller, and you would have to really fill in the blanks yourself. And most of his career was within this time.
Yeah. So there's a
interesting,
there's a whole raft of scholarship on what people claim. And I'm sympathetic to this. People claim to be a subtle subversion of the code, especially after the war. In the 1950s with noir, and late 1940s in particular, 1950s with noir, the noir films, film noir, Hitchcock and others. So a lot of scholars have sort of, film scholars have sort of read those films as containing implicit subversive messages. Like, for instance, there's so many characters in that period in the 40s and 50s who we might read as being gay, but weren't explicitly so in the films. Or there are, you know, sort of implicit sexual suggestions in the films. There's a flouting of authority, sort of very subtly though, in those films. But again, this is all sort of post-war. This is after the apex of the New Deal culturally.
It's an interesting experiment in thought to apply that backdrop of history to film, right? Like, I could tell you, I mean, I knew a lot about film, and I could tell you, like, what was the best picture of 1941 or 42. One of those years was Citizen Kane. So it's interesting to think, I've always separated like the film chronology from history. So to think about what's going on in film, I mean, sometimes it's obvious, but just to think about Citizen Kane is like a movie that came out right at the beginning of World War II. And all these films that came out in the late 60s, I guess conveniently at the time that they lift the code and switched the rating systems, but also pretty much at the height of the Vietnam War, you know, these very, very rebellious films. So that was a really good point about Hitchcock, because it's all about in his films what he doesn't show you, right? So he's working his way through this career in the 40s and the 50s, and obviously culminating in the late 50s and early 60s with films like Rear Window and Vertigo and Psycho, that he is breaking the code, but not overtly so.
I mean, Psycho was pretty screwed up.
Yeah,
right. So
I think Hitchcock's a great example. So what Hitchcock does is that he implies things that are banned by the code.
Right. Yeah.
So what you're doing when you're watching those films, you're constantly thinking about precisely the things that are banned by the code. you're thinking about seduction and rape and vulgarity and obscenity and violence and nudity and sex. As that's all you're thinking about when you're watching Hitchcock films, right?
Right. Yeah.
But he does it in a way that actually abides by the code. It's quite brilliant.
And back to people who are following the code, there was one more theme that I wanted to talk about that was very prevalent in the 1930s in film, the regimentation of society, which is obviously one of the most important principles of progressivism.
Yes, right.
So
yeah, it's a very important word. Now, they weren't fully successful, of course. I mean, the United States never looked exactly like Nazi Germany.
Right.
And we have to be careful, you know, to not say that. I mean, it just wasn't the case. But here's what we do know. The New Dealers wanted it, and you just have to look at Roosevelt's own words and the words of his cabinet members. They wanted a regimented society. They said it. I mean, Rexford Tugwell repeatedly called for making all of American culture into a giant factory, making people into machines. And Roosevelt, all the New Dealers, but especially Roosevelt, constantly used militaristic martial language.
Yeah.
Constantly was describing the United States and America as an army, and we are fighting a war against poverty. We are fighting a war against this and that and the other thing. We are fighting a war against disorder.
It's more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms. Give me your help, not to win votes alone, but to win in this crusade to restore America to its own people.
Yeah, there's no question at all that progressives and the New Dealers in particular really always dreamt of regimented society. And this is, again, I'm not the first person to say this. This is not that strange of a analysis of progressivism. I'd say roughly half historians who study them would agree with me on that. But it's just everywhere. You just look at the language. This is what these guys were dreaming about. Now, I mean, we all hate them. I know that. The four of us. But it is also important to sort of step back and at least understand why they wanted that. And, you know, they were living in a society that was in flux. The progressivism was born, this is crucial to understand, it was born during and in response to the great wave of immigration at the turn of the 20th century. It was very much a response to that. It was very much a response to millions and millions of people flooding into the United States who didn't speak English, who brought vast extended families with them instead of one little nuclear family, who didn't believe in the Protestant work ethic, who drank wine during the day, who danced to vulgar music that was foreign to the United States, or even worse, they danced to black music, who did vaudeville, the Irish, the Italians, I mean, the not so much the Irish, the Italian Jews, all these people from these countries that were very foreign and had foreign cultures. And they're filling the streets, literally, of American cities. And so I'm not sympathetic to progressives, who, by the way, were almost to a person WASP middle and upper class people. But that's what it was. You know, you're a WASP in a townhome in Manhattan in 1880, and your family's been there for 100 years. And all of a sudden, you're surrounded by all these people speaking Yiddish and dancing in the streets, and their children are running around naked or half naked. That's where this intense desire for social order comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's pretty damn intense if you consider some of the lengths they go to, or they talk about going to, like at the turn of the century with eugenics in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely.
Racial purity was a prominent theme in New Deal culture. Eugenics, a doctrine organized around the belief that the human race can and should be perfected by encoding breeding among superior people and preventing breeding among the inferior, is commonly associated with the Nazi regime. However, Nazis learned much of what they knew about eugenics from Americans. And while the Roosevelt administration never officially promoted eugenics, as the Nazis did, its forerunners introduced the doctrine, and the New Deal was born during the heyday of American eugenics. By the mid-1930s, 41 states prohibited marriage among the feeble-minded and insane, and 30 allowed eugenic sterilization. In Alabama, those considered by the state to be feeble-minded were involuntarily sterilized. In California, the law also allowed for habitual criminals, idiots, and mental defectives to be forced to have the surgery. Connecticut committed those with inherited tendency to crime to be sterilized. Laws in 14 states applied to epileptics. Moral degenerates and sexual perverts were sterilized in North Dakota, Oregon, and Washington. Morally degenerate persons in Idaho and Iowa. In Wisconsin, the law applied to criminal persons. According to historian Stephen Selden, author of Inheriting Shame, The Story of Eugenics and Racism in America, eugenic ideology was deeply embedded in American popular culture during the 1920s and 1930s. Films such as The Black Stork promoted the sterilization of unfit women. Many ministers taught their congregations that genetically superior people should be careful to avoid marrying someone from an inferior gene pool. State fairs across the country featured Fitter Families exhibits that offered free eugenic evaluations. Those who received low scores were warned that they might be among those Americans who were born to be a burden on the rest. High scorers were given medals proclaiming, "Yay, I have a goodly heritage!" In the 1930s, most high school science textbooks included lessons in eugenics, including the concept of fit and unfit races and the need to sterilize the unfit to preserve American culture. American eugenics and the New Deal were both progeny of the progressives. They saw in it a means to extend their mission of social planning into the bedroom and the maternity ward, to regulate the population at its genesis.
Last night I was writing a piece about the head of the National Conference of Social Workers. This guy was his name was Robert Woods. He founded the first settlement house in Boston called South End House. So he was kind of, this is during World War I, he was basically the most prominent, important social worker, settlement house leader, major progressive. And he was he gave a major speech about how wonderful the war was because it forced regimentation on the people, that it required domestic surveillance, which not only got rid of all the dissidents and all the foreign spies, but it also caused people to live orderly lives, to obey the law, to obey authority. And he finishes it by saying, and the best thing is, the war is forcing America to adopt two principles that will save our country. One was the prohibition of alcohol, and the other was the elimination of genetically inferior people. Yeah. So the eugenics thing fades away by the New Deal. They're not really, they don't talk about it explicitly, although sterilization is still going on. And in fact, I show this in my book, in Renegade. If you look at the numbers, and this, I think I'm the first historian to do this, if you look at the numbers of sterilizations, which begin in earnest in the early progressive period in the 1910s, but if you chart them, and they sort of basically end in the 1950s, but if you chart the numbers of sterilizations in the United States during that period, they spike in the 1930s during the New Deal. Now, New Dealers never, as far as I know, ever explicitly called for eugenic sterilization.
Right.
But I don't think it's a coincidence.
Well, as far as policy, they never call for it. But the New Deal is staffed with a lot of people, right, who were trying to push that agenda decades earlier, like Margaret Sanger.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, the whole thrust of American formal culture, and I say formal meaning the culture that comes from the top, during this period is, as we've been saying, toward regimentation, toward order and discipline. So if you got retarded people and promiscuous women, those are the targets, by the way, of eugenics, primary targets, and people who have been in, who are in families who have been poor for generations, well, goddamn. I mean, what's a more efficient way of achieving social order than eliminating them?
It's follow through. If you think, you know, society should be regimented and everyone serves their purpose and the army of America, you know, and everything's a machine, you don't want extra screws lying around. It's just the conclusion of that attitude.
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, if we can stop them from breeding, I mean, of course, it relies on a false scientific assumption that prostitutes will breed further more prostitutes. But it certainly sends a message. I'll tell you that, you know, there's no question about that. Women certainly received a very powerful message that if it wasn't, by the way, and this is another thing people don't know, it wasn't just prostitutes who were sterilized, which is as horrible enough. It was often women who were simply accused of or convicted of being promiscuous, sexually promiscuous. The message was sent really clearly to women, you know,
because they didn't get it when they were being burnt at the stake for the same reason.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, it's about 40,000 women were forcibly sterilized by court order during this period. That's something we should never, ever forget.
Well, and post-World War II, you know, what people don't realize is that one of the scariest positions that people held from 1900s up until almost now is social workers. So social workers always held as kind of like martyr, like, oh, they're the great people who are helping out society. But, I mean, throughout the last 100 years, they've been some of the most evil people you could possibly find. And in North Carolina, it wasn't up until 1974 that North Carolina Supreme Court stated, well, social workers aren't allowed to just willy-nilly call for sterilizations. So in North Carolina, it was particularly disgusting because social worker could just basically dislike their neighbor. And there's accounts of this. It's insane. They dislike their neighbor. They call in the false report. They go to the house. They go, this person, you know, they're not really fit for having kids. They already have three kids. Cops would go into the house and forcibly sterilize some of these people inside their homes. And you had a lot of boys who were sterilized inside house and they died. They died in front of these people. And, you know, at the backdrop of all these social work agencies, where people don't realize the fact that it's been a eugenics plan.
You just said that cops sterilized.
The cops would actually tie these people down, and then you'd have some kind of doctor who would be sterilizing these individuals. Although we're talking about people who are in places like med school, or in certain cases, things like nurses.
I'm so silly. I thought that was a new thing, because I forget which state it's in. I think California, actually, where the cops will actually physically tie you down and take your blood.
Oh, they're just taking your blood, though.
Yeah, at least they're not snipping your dick. But no, this has been going on forever. And whenever you want to really look at the nastiness of eugenics, what you'll see is there's a more blunt view as far as in the South is concerned when it comes to sterilization. Like, they're just more open about it. But California had the highest number of sterilizations far and away.
Woohoo, home state.
Yeah. So where I'm sitting was the ground zero of eugenics in the United States. Occidental College, and then there was a center in Pasadena. I'm right next to Pasadena. I'm in right in between the two of those. The National Center for Eugenics, I forget the actual name of it, but it was run by a guy named Paul Popenoe, who's in my book.
Paul Popenoe, the most influential American eugenicist, was a leader in the progressive movement for social hygiene. During World War I, Popenoe was a captain in the U.S. Army Sanitary Corps, in charge of controlling liquor and vice in army camps, a major progressive cause. After the war, Popenoe's research and advocacy helped make California the leader in eugenic sterilizations. His book, Sterilization for Human Betterment, was one of the first American books translated into German by the Nazi government and it was widely cited by Hitler's racial hygiene theorists to justify the Nazis' own sterilization programs. In 1934, Popenoe praised Hitler for establishing his hopes of biological regeneration solidly on the application of biological principles of human society.
So yeah, you're right. California led the way in sterilization.
No, and the Rockefellers and Carnegies both paid for a lot of those things, and it's always incredibly creepy whenever you think about, you know, those are the same people who are also paying for TED Talks now. And during TED Talks, you repeatedly hear people talking about overpopulation, how we have to re-engineer society. And yeah. Though and all the times they don't necessarily mean sterilizing retards, you still get a little bit creeped out.
So, Carlos, you actually made me think of something. I've never seen anyone do work on this, and I don't know. I can't tell you for sure that it's true. But the spike in sterilizations during the 1930s, during the New Deal, I'm betting has something to do with the advent of social welfare.
Oh, it does. The book we've been talking about, I mean, social welfare has such a large dynamic when it comes to this. And LBJ stuff, you know, in regards to creating this great case for Black communities in order to uprise them from poverty. Social workers in the South would go to Black women's homes where people were on food stamps, right? And say, if you don't get sterilized, we will take away your food stamps. Right?
Oh, sure. Yeah,
and yeah. Native American societies where, well, not even societies, they're artificial societies created by the government, right? These reservations. Right. So you stick these Native Americans, these places where you create a tyrannical society whereby none of the normal people are allowed to be able to have any kind of private property. There's no real trade or outward trade that's allowed to occur. Then they go up to these Native American women. And if you don't have the same nuclear family, you know, one woman, one man and all the kids, if say even a grandma's in the house, they go, well, this is unnatural and not great for the kids. So we're going to restrict any kind of money going into your home, and the tribal leader will do it as well because they're basically a servant of the state in a way as well, because, I mean, it keeps them able to get their monopoly. And you have to get sterilized or else essentially you starve to death. So it was totally intertwined with welfare. It was intertwined with essentially keeping the minorities down in any single way that they possibly could. It started with Francis Galton, and then it just went on from there.
Right.
Yeah.
So Popenoe was like a big fan of what they were doing in Germany and lamented frequently about why isn't that happening here? But at least Germany seemed to have a pretty active positive eugenics plan. It doesn't seem like we had that. We're worse. Well, until they went to the extremes.
Well, no, I mean, we had 100,000 sterilizations in the United States. That is a lot.
That's sterilization, so that would be negative eugenics. I think what Brett means by positive eugenics, which
putting the handsomes together.
Oh, no. Well, actually, in the South, they would go up to interracial couples, and they would basically tear up their marriage contracts.
Right, but you're still talking about negative eugenics. So, like, what they were doing in Germany was that they were, like, picking out, what, blonde, blue-eyed girls, and...
Selective breeding. What you're talking about.
Yeah, well, okay. So when it comes to, obviously, when we consider how everything played out in Germany and the question of who's in the black and who's in the red, as far as United States versus Germany, obviously they're significantly and tragically in the red, but they at least, it didn't seem like that even existed in the United States. That United States eugenics that the Germans borrowed, obviously, as far as the ideas were concerned, was entirely about negative eugenics, was entirely about sterilization.
Well, no, we did. There were contests, though, in the United States, right, where, like, white families would go there and there'd be a contest to show who the most attractive person is, basically who fit the correct genes according to the eugenics plan, and then they'd be given awards. So you'd be given awards if... You were a perfect Aryan couple. So that's kind of positive eugenics.
No, they did. Thad, you talk about that in the book, the Fitter Families exhibits.
Yeah. There was a tremendous public relations campaign for eugenics. I was going to say there's a really good book, and it's a scholarly book written by a professor called, I think it's called The Nazi Connection, which shows, and it's indisputable, that the Nazis learned most of what they knew about eugenics from American so-called scientists like Paul Popenoe.
Yeah, well, I should check that out, because that's what my show is all about, drawing parallels between the Nazis and the Americans.
Well, no, and honestly, Edwin Black, War on the Week, and IBM and the Holocaust, both those books are really, really great. War on the Week is phenomenal. I mean, it is lengthy, but the amount of resources he has is fantastic.
We do have to say something. There is something positive about eugenics, though. It did give rise to birth control. Yeah. So when people talk about Margaret Sanger, the emotions start flying and we cease to have a rational discourse about her. So she was absolutely, totally eugenicist. If you go to the Planned Parenthood website, there is this massive denial of that on it. Until recently, they insisted that she was not a eugenicist, but it's absolutely indisputable if you read almost anything she wrote. You know, in the famous Harlem Project of the 1940s.
The Negro Project.
The Negro Project, yeah, which was, and also, so that was the black political leadership of the time also. They joined together to establish birth control clinics in Harlem. Now, and she was, of course, had been establishing birth control clinics in cities across the country. That's good. You know, that's great. I'm glad that gave rise to sexual freedom. Now that's not what she intended.
But they did specifically target African-American communities, right? So they would have these kind of charity balls in order to be able to get money for these Planned Parenthood. Although at the time, I can't remember the name of the clinic. And they would, they basically, we're talking like there'd be 10 of these abortion clinics inside of a black community for every, you know, one in a white community. And yeah, that's why, well, and the thing is yes, we can say, okay, this did increase this positive thing. But when we look at the numbers, we have to be at least a little bit creeped out. I mean, in 2010, there were more abortions by black women in New York than there were births. And so as much as we want to go like, well, you know, abortion's not that bad and everything else, you know, whenever you actually fit it into context, there is something eerily uncomfortable about that fact.
Yeah, I know. But she was also giving out rubbers and diaphragms to lots and lots of people, not just black people. And she started in Brooklyn. You know, I mean, yes, it was racist and eugenicist to the bone in terms of its intentions, the motivations behind it, but its consequences were not all bad.
It had like a secondary positive outcome.
Yeah, right? And we have to recognize that. I don't give her, I mean, I'm not being sympathetic one bit to her.
Yeah, no, you can't.
I'm just saying, you know, there are unintended positive consequences to the most authoritarian measures.
It's really hard to be sympathetic to someone who said, niggers needed to be rooted out like weeds. I mean, this is the person who, you know, oh, civil rights and women's rights and you keep using these words, like nouns in front of rights, and then you actually look at what these people were behind.
Yeah, she was a straight-up racist. I mean, no doubt about it. Yeah, but I'm glad she existed nonetheless, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that would be actually a nice way to wrap up today, Thad, because I know you have to go, focusing on some of the accidental positive contributions of some of history's most horrible people. Like, take the Nazis, for example. They're building these UFO-looking things. The United States gets them, brings them to New Mexico or wherever, starts trying to fly them around. We get 60 good years of UFO paranoia in this country.
Hey, we got the moon landing. I mean, if it wasn't for Nazi scientists, we would have not been able to get to the moon.
Absolutely. Von Braun. Thank you,
Hitler, for Von Braun.
We get American academia staffed sufficiently for 60 years by scientists and academics fleeing the Third Reich.
Yeah, it's great.
So thanks to all those people.
Sorry for turning as negative as I did, but
no, that's okay. So Thad, I know you need to go. Do you have time for one more question that can help us tie this together?
Sure.
When you look back at this period, Hollywood and the press in the 1930s, as far as residuals are concerned, how much of today's mainstream media, entertainment industry, and film industry do you think was formed during that time?
During the code?
Yeah. Or during the New Deal, during the subservience to this agenda. Not just the New Deal, but also the war, because that's like a good 15 years right there of a very subservient press and subservient Hollywood.
I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about this recently. I mean, after the code, as you mentioned earlier, you know, from the late 60s, certainly through the 70s, I mean, there's a lot of fantastic anti-war movies and anti-government movies, right? So post-Watergate especially, my God, I mean, it was really the golden age of anti-authoritarianism in Hollywood. You know, a lot of movies about police corruption, I'm thinking of Serpico. I mean, really, really great liberatory stuff. That is not the case anymore. What's going on now with Zero Dark 30 and all this shit that's, you know, and like, what was the movie that the Marine Corps made with Hollywood recently?
The military is getting a lot of influence over a lot of productions, including Transformers.
Totally. I meant the one that where the Marines are actually in the movie and they actually co-produced it. Call of Honor? Call of something? Anyway.
Yeah, that idea.
Anyway, there's a bunch of pro-war movies going on now. So I don't know if the lineage of that is the New Deal, mm-hmm. because there was this wonderful moment, which was at least a decade long, you know, late 60s and 70s, where that wasn't the case. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you can really trace the current. Oh, the Marky Mark. Yes, right. What's that called? The Afghanistan.
Is this Survivor?
Lone Survivor.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, but that, as we're saying, it's one of like 50 movies recently that's like that. Yeah, I don't know if the lineage of that we can really trace to the deal.
Well, the interesting thing is like there's these pockets of resistance, right? In the late 1960s, early to the mid 1970s. Then it seems like.
It's Rambo, by the way. It's First Blood. And Rambo. It's the this no, I think we can trace this. This is a different story, I think. You trace it to the backlash to the anti-Vietnam War movement, which began with First Blood, Rambo, that movie, right? It was the veterans, it's kind of this wounded national pride trope.
Yeah.
It's not really the kind of corporatist, progressive, imperialist militarism of the 30s. It's more the John McCain, we must defend our honor thing, I think, against the countercultural hippie commies.
Right.
I think that's really more what's going on now.
By almost 20 years ago, like in the mid 90s, we start seeing films like Independence Day right before 9/11. You have Pearl Harbor with Ben Affleck. And there's other examples like that going right up to today with Zero Dark Thirty and the Wahlberg movie that we mentioned. So it seems like there's these pockets of rebellion and resistance in Hollywood and in other forms of entertainment media. Some television is pretty subversive. It usually doesn't last very long. So
what I'm doing is I'm trying to draw a distinction between imperialism, which is what the New Dealers were, mm-hmm. which was we must go to other countries and convert them to our way of life, and we must convert the poor people in our own country to our way of life. Drawing a distinction between that and those movies with the current crop of pro-war movies, which I think are not that. They're not imperialist. They're sort of this masculine, nationalist, primitive expression of having to kill the bad guys, right? And that begins with Rambo. It's kind of the John McCain ethos. John McCain's not like a neocon in the sense that he wants to make the world safe for democracy and convert people to our way of life. I mean, I think it's really more about sort of defending our national honor, our national pride. It's very masculine. I think that's more what's going on now. So I don't think it's quite the same.
Isn't it also, it sounds to me like it's also an act of desperation. Maybe they realize they're losing the culture war. I mean, the Marines co-producing a movie, that's pretty insane to me. And also, Hollywood is not one monolithic thing anymore. Brett mentioned TV shows, but then there's also Netflix, and there's media coming from so many different places.
Totally.
House of Cards. I really like House of Cards. They are all assholes in government. There's like no good politician in that show.
Yeah. Oh no, that's absolutely, that's a crucial point. Not at all monolithic, right? So the kind of movies I'm talking about, I lump them under what I call formal culture, right? Culture from the top down. So it's the Navy SEALs co-produced it. But anyway, you know, when the Navy SEALs are co-producing a film, that's top down formal culture.
Yeah.
That's literally the government telling us things. But no, of course, there's all sorts of stuff bubbling up from what I call popular culture, which is from the bottom up, essentially. It's the expression of people's desires.
And it certainly can't be like the elite are controlling everything, which is kind of a conspiracy that's brought up, because the two most important TV shows in history just have been out in the last 5 years, which is House of Cards and Breaking Bad. And both,
right.
In both things, you have the bad guys are the politicians, or the good guys are kind of crazy drug dealers.
Okay. So yes, but the movies that are co-produced by the military are conspiracies.
Yes.
You know, that's just, there's no doubt about that. Those are deliberate attempts by the United States government to influence our ideas. There's no doubt about that. Now, all these other movies and TV shows, no, of course not. Those are business people meeting market demand. So yeah, no, it's a war going on. It's a cultural civil war that's been going on, as I say in the book, since the pilgrims got here.
So we know you're out of time. We appreciate all the time you spent, Thad. And you want to do one more call-in show with us?
Sure.
You and Carlos can get into whatever issues Carlos
Salty
has.
Salty versus spicy.
Salty versus spicy, we'll call it.
It's going to be about violence, okay?
Yeah,
yeah.
Good.
We'll let people call if they want, so I'll promote it, and we'll figure out a time within the next couple weeks, hopefully, when we can do that.
Sounds good.
All right, thank you so much for your time. Have a good weekend.
Thanks a lot, guys. Bye.
the Second World War appeared to many contemporary observers, and still appears to many historians, as proof of a fundamental antagonism between fascism and the American way of life. Many have seen the war as evidence that, in particular, the New Deal liberal way of life was hostile to fascism. After all, while many Republicans and other enemies of the New Deal were opposed to fighting fascism abroad, Roosevelt led the nation to war against Germany, Italy, and Japan. More than 400,000 Americans died in the fight, and the Roosevelt administration made sure to not just defeat the fascist regimes, but to obliterate them. But the evidence of their similarities suggests that the New Deal and fascism went to war not over ideas or values or a way of life. Rather, it seems, the war was a struggle between brothers for control of the world family.
I didn't come off as a retard during a school sex podcast. That's great. I feel wonderful about that.
Do you feel like you usually come off as a retard?
I usually come off as just abrasive and like kind of silly.
Yeah.
Instead of having like legitimate things to bring to the conversation.
Yeah.
This time I actually did. Like I was like, holy shit, eugenics. Yes. I got tons of shit on this. Like I'm making connections that other writers have not yet done.
We have a policy on School Sucks. If any guest appears or co-host appears to be retarded, they have to take out their testicles and I poke at them with a scalpel until I'm confident that they're not going to reproduce. So, but it's just a poking. It's very little blood.
I like the amount of poking that you're doing in that particular case.
Yeah.
Are we live right now?
Yeah, we are.
Hey, folks.